How remorseful we might feel in the aftermath of committing a terrible act. Most of us, if we are lucky, will only commit petty hurtful acts, the kinds of hurt that can be forgiven. The man who committed this atrocity in Norway has a capacity to hurt few of us will ever understand. He turned himself in. He confessed to his crimes. He wants to explain himself. I don't know what that means, but it has to mean something. I wonder if he was scared before he took so many lives, before he created such unprecedented destruction. I wonder how he became the kind of man who could shoot children at point-blank range, who could be so careless with human lives. I wonder if he is sickened by what he did. I wonder how he feels, knowing he lives in a country where he will likely not be sentenced to life in prison, knowing that even in the face of what he did, he will not be put to death. I wonder if he is grateful, if he is humbled, if he is staggered by the humanity of his people. Tragedy. Call. Humility. Response. After the Norway tragedy, my on-again, off-again boyfriend called from many states away. He is politically conservative, though I'd like to think I've worn him down on certain matters. He asked, "Have you seen the news?" He asked, "Do you still believe the death penalty is wrong?" Tragedy. Call. Dial tone. Response. We know much of what there is to know about Anders Behring Breivik. We know very little about his victims, who they were, what they wanted for their lives, how they loved and were loved, who they loved, how, and by whom they will be mourned, what they felt in their last moments, if they suffered. We only know 77 people were killed in one day by one man. Their killer is alive. There is a great deal of cruelty in this state of affairs. I'm not a saint. I will not shed a tear for Anders Behring Breivik, but I do not wish him dead. I will try to think of him with the compassion he was unable to offer the 77 people he murdered. I will likely fail in this. Still, I do not wish him dead. I do not believe his death is an appropriate punishment. I do not believe there is such a thing as an appropriate punishment for what that man did. This is the modern age. When tragedies occur, we take to Twitter and Facebook and blogs to share our thoughts and feelings. We do this to know that maybe, just maybe, we are not alone in our confusion or grief or sorrow, or to believe we have a voice in what happens in the world. We take to these tools of the modern age, and there are those among us who, in the wake of tragedy, point fingers or proselytize or use humor as a means of distancing themselves from the emotional discomfort of knowing we are rarely as safe as we hope to be. We are rarely safe from knowing that every day terrible things happen everywhere. Tragedy. Call. Twitter. Response. Others use this time to take a political stance, to speculate as to why blonde-haired, blue-eyed men aren't now being profiled in airports around the world. There is almost a certain glee in these kinds of statements. At a time like this, tragedy is used for political posturing. Righteousness gets in the way of what is right. Righteousness gets in the way of valid observations that might be better shared more carefully, more thoughtfully, under different circumstances. The tools of the modern age afford us many privileges, but they also cost us the privilege of time and space and distance to properly think through tragedy, to take a deep breath, to feel, to care. Tragedy. Call. Heart. Response. Tragedy. Call. Mind. Response. There is a girl who was a woman, but really she was a girl. She was a girl because she was only 27, had only lived a third of a life. She had a voice like fine whiskey and cigarettes, or at least what I imagine fine whiskey and cigarettes might sound like. She had a voice that made me think of dark, secret nightclubs, where you need to know a guy to gain admittance, where musicians gather closely on a small stage and play their instruments for hours in a haze of sweat and cologne, booze and smoke. While a singer, this girl-woman singer, stands at the microphone, giving those gathered the exceptional gift of her voice. The year her second album came out was the year of the Halloween, dedicated to this girl-woman. Everywhere I looked, women and some men wore their hair or a wig, long and black with a bouffant on top, and they lined their eyes blackly with that distinctive angle at the corner of each eye. And they drew tattoos on their bare arms and sang the chorus of her most popular song. They tried to make me go to rehab. Call. I said no, no, no. Response. That's why we care. She was in our lives, and our ears, and our heads, and our hair. The girl-woman singer died in her flat, alone in bed. Too many people said it was to be expected, because we knew this girl who was a woman was really a girl. We knew she had problems, and she did not have the luxury the rest of us do to handle our problems privately, with dignity. She was a mess. So what? We are all stinking messes, every last one of us, or we once were messes and found our way out, or we are trying to find our way out of a mess, scratching, reaching. We knew she had demons that were bigger than her, demons she tried to fight or she didn't. We can't possibly know. Her struggles were documented and parodied, celebrated, and ridiculed. Celebrity. Call. Gossip. Response. We have seen the pictures of this girl-woman in the street, barefoot, her midriff bare and swollen, her makeup smeared, her unforgettable hair stringy, pasted to her pale face, her body being carried from her home in a red body bag. There was no privacy for her, not even in death. That is a tragedy, too. I love her music and listen to it regularly. I always hoped she might survive herself. Hoped she would give her adoring fans more of her voice. Hoped she would give herself the blessing of a long life. I heard she died from my best friend, who sent me a text message, and we commiserated about what a shame it was for a girl woman to die at the age of 27. It is a different kind of devastating to think about the life she will never know, about those gifts that come with more years of living. I do not wonder about the cause of her death. The how of her demise isn't my business, and yet, when I first heard of her death, I wondered if she died alone. I wondered if she was scared. There is fear, and there is fear. Now I wonder if she knew real happiness in her short life. I wonder if she felt loved or knew peace. She was someone's daughter. She was someone's sister. We know her father found out while he was on a plane. He did not have any kind of privacy to make sense of surviving his child. The death of a child is unbearable and suffocating. After Amy Winehouse's death, her parents had to try to cope with something the human heart is ill-equipped to withstand. Tragedy. Call. Broken heart. Response. I followed many conversations about what happened in Norway and the death of Amy Winehouse because they happened one after the next. Too many of those conversations tried to conflate the two events, tried to create some kind of hierarchy of tragedy, grief, call, response. There was so much judgment, so much interrogation of grief. How dare we mourn a singer, an entertainer? A girl-woman who struggled with addiction, as if the life of an addict is somehow less worthy a life. As if we are not entitled to mourn unless the tragedy happens to the right kind of people. How dare we mourn a singer, when across an ocean, 77 people are dead. We are asked these questions as if we only have the capacity to mourn one tragedy at a time. As if we must measure the depth and reach of a tragedy before deciding how to respond. As if compassion and kindness are finite resources we must use sparingly. We cannot put these two tragedies on a chart and connect them with a straight line. We cannot understand these tragedies neatly. Death is a tragedy, whether it is the death of one girl woman in London or 77 men, women, and children in Norway. We know this, but perhaps it needs to be said over and over again so we do not forget. I have never considered compassion a finite resource. I would not want to live in a world where such was the case. Tragedy. Call. Great. Small. Compassion. Response. Compassion. Response. Back to me. Bad feminist, take one. My favorite definition of feminist is one offered by Sue, an Australian woman who, when interviewed for Kathy Bale's 1996 anthology DIY Feminism, said feminists are just women who don't want to be treated like shit. This definition is pointed and succinct, but I run into trouble when I try to expand that definition. I fall short as a feminist. I feel like I am not as committed as I need to be, that I am not living up to feminist ideals because of who and how I choose to be. I feel this tension constantly. As Judith Butler writes in her 1988 essay, Performative Acts and Gender Constitution, performing one's gender wrong initiates a set of punishments, both obvious and indirect, and performing it well provides the reassurance that there is an essentialism of gender identity after all. This tension, the idea that there is a right way to be a woman, a right way to be the most essential woman, is ongoing and pervasive. We see this tension in socially dictated beauty standards. The right way to be a woman is to be thin, to wear makeup, to wear the right kind of clothes, not too slutty, not too prudish, show a little leg, ladies, and so on. Good women are charming, polite, and unobtrusive. Good women work but are content to earn 77% of what men earn, or, depending on whom you ask, good women bear children and stay home to raise those children without complaint. Good women are modest, chaste, pious, submissive. Women who don't adhere to these standards are the fallen, the undesirable. They are bad women. Butler's thesis could also apply to feminism. There is an essential feminism, or as I perceive this essentialism, the notion that there are right and wrong ways to be a feminist, and that there are consequences for doing feminism wrong. Essential feminism suggests anger, humorlessness, militancy, unwavering principles, and a prescribed set of rules for how to be a proper feminist woman, or at least a proper white, heterosexual feminist woman. Hate pornography, unilaterally decry the objectification of women, don't cater to the male gaze, hate men, hate sex, focus on career, don't shave. I kid, mostly, with that last one. This is nowhere near an accurate description of feminism, but the movement has been warped by misperception for so long that even people who should know better have bought into this essential image of feminism. Consider Elizabeth Wurtzel, who in a June 2012 Atlantic article says, "Real feminists earn a living, have money and means of their own." By Wurtzel's thinking, women who don't earn a living, have money and means of their own, are fake feminists, undeserving of the label, a disappointment to the sisterhood. She takes the idea of essential feminism even further in a September 2012 Harper's Bazaar article, where she suggests that a good feminist works hard to be beautiful. She says, looking great is a matter of feminism. No liberated woman would misrepresent the cause by appearing less than hale and happy. It's too easy to dissect the error of such thinking. She is suggesting that a woman's worth is in part determined by her beauty, which is one of the very things feminism works against. The most significant problem with essential feminism is how it doesn't allow for the complexities of human experience or individuality. There seems to be little room for multiple or discordant points of view. Essential feminism has, for example, led to the rise of the phrase sex-positive feminism, which creates a clear distinction between feminists who are positive about sex and feminists who aren't, which in turn creates a self-fulfilling essentialist prophecy. I sometimes cringe when I am referred to as a feminist, as if I should be ashamed of my feminism or as if the word feminist is an insult. The label is rarely offered in kindness. I am generally called a feminist when I have the nerve to suggest that the misogyny so deeply embedded in our culture is a real problem requiring relentless vigilance. The essay in this collection about Daniel Tosh and rape jokes originally appeared in Salon. I tried not to read the comments because they get vicious. But I couldn't help but note one commenter who told me I was an angry blogger woman, which is simply another way of saying angry feminist. All feminists are angry instead of, say, passionate. A more direct reprimand came from a man I was dating during a heated discussion that wasn't quite an argument. He said, "Don't you raise your voice to me," which was strange because I had not raised my voice. I was stunned because no one had ever said such a thing to me. He expounded at length about how women should talk to men. When I dismantled his pseudo-theories, he said, "You're some kind of feminist, aren't you?" There was a tone to his accusation, making it clear that to be a feminist was undesirable. I was not being a good woman. I remained silent, stewing. I thought, isn't it obvious I am a feminist, albeit not a very good one? I also realized I was being chastised for having a certain set of beliefs. The experience was disconcerting, at best. I'm not the only outspoken woman who shies away from the feminist label, who fears the consequences of accepting the label. In an August 2012 interview with Salon's Andrew O'Hur, actress Melissa Leo, known for playing groundbreaking female roles, said, "Well, I don't think of myself as a feminist at all. As soon as we start labeling and categorizing ourselves and others, that's going to shut down the world." I would never say that. Like, I just did that episode with Louis C.K. Leo is buying into a great many essential feminist myths with her comment. We are categorized and labeled from the moment we come into this world by gender, race, size, hair color, eye color, and so forth. The older we get, the more labels and categories we collect. If labeling and categorizing ourselves is going to shut the world down, it has been a long time coming. More disconcerting, though, is the assertion that a feminist wouldn't take a role on Louis C.K.'s sitcom, Louie, or that a feminist would be unable to find C.K.'s brand of humor amusing. For Leo, there are feminists, and then there are women who defy categorization and are willing to embrace career opportunities. Trailbreaking female leaders in the corporate world tend to reject the feminist label, too. Marissa Mayer, who was appointed president and CEO of Yahoo in July 2012, said in an interview, "I don't think that I would consider myself a feminist. I think that I certainly believe in equal rights. I believe that women are just as capable, if not more so, in a lot of different dimensions. But I don't, I think, have sort of the militant drive and the sort of the chip on the shoulder that sometimes comes with that. And I think it's too bad, but I do think that feminism has become in many ways a more negative word, you know, There are amazing opportunities all over the world for women, and I think that there is more good that comes out of positive energy around that than comes out of negative energy. For Mayer, even though she is a pioneering woman, feminism is associated with militancy and preconceived notions. Feminism is negative, and despite the feminist strides she has made through her career at Google and now Yahoo, she'd prefer to eschew the label for the sake of so-called positive energy. Audre Lorde once stated, "I am a black feminist. I mean, I recognize that my power as well as my primary oppressions come as a result of my blackness as well as my womanness, and therefore my struggles on both these fronts are inseparable. As a woman of color, I find that some feminists don't seem terribly concerned with the issues unique to women of color. The ongoing effects of racism and post-colonialism, the status of women in the third world, the fight against the trenchant archetypes black women are forced into, angry black woman, mammy, hottentot, and the like. White feminists often suggest that by believing there are issues unique to women of color, an unnatural division occurs, impeding solidarity, sisterhood. Other times, white feminists are simply dismissive of these issues. In 2008, prominent blogger Amanda Marcotte was accused of appropriating ideas for her article, "Can a Person Be Illegal?" from the blogger Brown Femipower, who posted a speech she gave on the same subject a few days prior to the publication of Marcotte's article. The question of where original thought ends and borrowed concepts begin was complicated significantly in this case by the sense that a white person had yet again taken the creative work of a person of color. The feminist blogosphere engaged in an intense debate over these issues, at times so acrimonious. Black feminists were labeled radical black feminists, were accused of overreacting, and of course, playing the race card. Such willful ignorance, such willful disinterest in incorporating the issues and concerns of black women into the mainstream feminist project makes me disinclined to own the feminist label until it embraces people like me. Is that my way of essentializing feminism? Of suggesting there's a right kind of feminism or a more inclusive feminism? Perhaps. This is all murky for me, but a continued insensitivity within feminist circles on the matter of race is a serious problem. There's also this. Lately, magazines have been telling me there's something wrong with feminism or women trying to achieve a work-life balance or just women in general. The Atlantic has led the way in these lamentations. In the aforementioned June 2012 article, Elizabeth Wurtzel, author of Prozac Nation, wrote a searing polemic about 1% wives, who are hurting feminism and the progress of women by choosing to stay at home rather than enter the workplace. Wurtzel begins the essay provocatively, stating, "When my mind gets stuck on everything that is wrong with feminism, it brings out the 19th century poet in me. Let me count the ways. Most of all, feminism is pretty much a nice girl who really, really wants so badly to be liked by everybody. Ladies who lunch, men who hate women, all the morons who demand choice and don't understand responsibility. That it has become the easy lay of social movements." There are problems with feminism. Wurtzel says so, and she is vigorous in defending her position. Wurtzel knows the right way for feminism. In that article, Wurtzel goes on to state there is only one kind of equality, economic equality. And until women recognize that and enter the workforce en masse, feminists, and wealthy feminists in particular, will continue to fail. They will continue to be bad feminists, falling short of essential ideals of feminism. Wurtzel isn't wrong about the importance of economic equality, but she is wrong in assuming that with economic equality, the rest of feminism's concerns will somehow disappear. In the July-August 2012 Atlantic, Anne-Marie Slaughter wrote more than 12,000 words about the struggles of powerful, successful women to have it all. Her article was interesting and thoughtful for a certain kind of woman, a wealthy woman with a very successful career. She even parlayed the piece into a book deal. Slaughter was speaking to a small, elite group of women while ignoring the millions of women who don't have the privilege of, as Slaughter did, leaving high-powered positions at the State Department to spend more time with their sons. Many women who work do so because they have to. Working has little to do with having it all and much more to do with having food on the table. Slaughter wrote, "I'd been the woman congratulating herself on her unswerving commitment to the feminist cause, chatting smugly with her dwindling number of college or law school friends who had reached and maintained their place on the highest rungs of their profession. I'd been the one telling young women at my lectures that you can have it all and do it all, regardless of what field you are in. The thing is, I am not at all sure that feminism has ever suggested women can have it all. This notion of being able to have it all is always misattributed to feminism when really, it's human nature to want it all. To have cake and eat it too without necessarily focusing on how we can get there and how we can make having it all possible for a wider range of people and not just the lucky ones." Alas. Poor feminism. So much responsibility keeps getting piled on the shoulders of a movement whose primary purpose is to achieve equality in all realms between men and women. I keep reading these articles and getting angry and tired because they suggest there's no way for women to ever get it right. These articles make it seem like, as Butler suggests, there is, in fact, a right way to be a woman and a wrong way to be a woman. The standard for the right way to be a woman and or a feminist appears to be ever-changing and unachievable. In the weeks leading up to the publication of Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In, critics had plenty to say about the Facebook chief operating officer's ideas about being a woman in the workplace, even though few had actually read the tome. Many of the resulting discussions bizarrely mischaracterized Lean In, tossing around misleading headlines, inaccurate facts, and unfair assumptions. As it turns out, not even a fairly average entry into the world of corporate advice books is immune from double standards. Sandberg intersperses personal anecdotes from her remarkable career, a vice presidency at Google, serving as the U.S. Treasury's chief of staff during the Clinton administration, with observations, research, and pragmatic advice for how women can better achieve professional and personal success. She urges women to lean in to their careers and to be ambitious in any pursuit. Lean In is competently written, blandly interesting, and it does repeat a great deal of familiar research. Although it isn't particularly harmful to be reminded of the challenges women face as they try to get ahead. Intentionally or not, much of the book is a stark reminder of the many obstacles women face in the workplace. I cannot deny that parts resonated, particularly in Sandberg's discussion about imposter syndrome and how women are less willing to take advantage of potential career opportunities unless they feel qualified. But Sandberg is rigidly committed to the gender binary, and Lean In is exceedingly heteronormative. Professional women are largely defined in relation to professional men. Lean In's loudest unspoken advice seems to dictate that women should embrace traditionally masculine qualities, self-confidence, risk-taking, aggression, etc. Occasionally, this advice backfires because it seems as if Sandberg is advocating, if you want to succeed, be an asshole. In addition, Sandberg generally assumes a woman will want to fulfill professional ambitions while also marrying a man and having children. Yes, she says, not all women want careers, not all women want children, not all women want both. I would never advocate that we should all have the same objectives. But she contradicts herself by placing every single parable within the context of heterosexual women who want a wildly successful career and a rounded-out nuclear family. Accepting that Sandberg is writing to a very specific audience and has little to offer those who don't fall within that target demographic makes enjoying the book a lot easier. One of the main questions that has arisen in the wake of Lean In's publication is whether Sandberg has a responsibility to women who don't fall within her target demographic. Like Slaughter, Sandberg is speaking to a rather narrow group of women. In the New York Times, Jody Cantor writes, "Even Sandberg's advisors acknowledge the awkwardness of a woman with double Harvard degrees, dual stock riches from Facebook and Google, where she also worked, a 9,000-square-foot house, and a small army of household help urging less fortunate women to look inward and work harder." At times, the inescapable evidence of Sandberg's fortune is grating. She casually discusses her mentor Larry Summers, working for the Treasury Department, her doctor siblings, and her equally successful husband, David Goldberg, as CEO of SurveyMonkey. Goldberg moved the company headquarters from Portland to the Bay Area so he could more fully commit to his family. She gives the impression that her movement from one ideal situation to the next is easily replicable. Sandberg's life is so absurd a fairy tale, I began to think of Lean In as a snow globe, where a lovely little tableau was being nicely preserved for my delectation and irritation. I would not be so bold as to suggest Sandberg has it all, but I need to believe she is pretty damn close to whatever having it all might look like. Common sense dictates that it is not realistic to assume anyone could achieve Sandberg's success simply by leaning in and working harder. But that doesn't mean Sandberg has nothing to offer or that Lean In should be summarily dismissed. Cultural critics can get a bit precious and condescending about marginalized groups, and in the debate over Lean In, working class women have been lumped into a vaguely defined group of women who work too hard for too little money. But very little consideration has been given to these women as actual people who live in the world, and who maybe, just maybe, have ambitions too. There has been, unsurprisingly, significant pushback against the notion that leaning in is a reasonable option for working class women, who are already stretched woefully thin. Sandberg is not oblivious to her privilege, noting, "I am fully aware that most women are not focused on changing social norms for the next generation, but simply trying to get through each day. 40% of employed mothers lack sick days and vacation leave, and about 50% of employed mothers are unable to take time off to care for a sick child. Only about half of women receive any pay during maternity leave. These policies can have severe consequences. Families with no access to paid family leave often go into debt and can fall into poverty. Part-time jobs with fluctuating schedules offer little chance to plan and often stop short of the 40-hour week that provides basic benefits." It would have been useful if Sandberg offered realistic advice about career management for women who are dealing with such circumstances. It would also be useful if we had flying cars. Assuming Sandberg's advice is completely useless for working-class women is just as short-sighted as claiming her advice needs to be completely applicable to all women. And let's be frank, if Sandberg chose to offer career advice for working-class women, a group she clearly knows little about, she would have been just as harshly criticized for overstepping her bounds. The critical response to Lean In is not entirely misplaced, but it is emblematic of the dangers of public womanhood. Public women, and feminists in particular, have to be everything to everyone. When they aren't, they are excoriated for their failure. In some ways, this is understandable. We have come far, but we have so much further to go. We need so very much, and we hope women with a significant platform might be everything we need, a desperately untenable position. As Elizabeth Spears notes in The Verge, when's the last time someone picked up a Jack Welch or Warren Buffett or even Donald Trump bestseller and complained that it was unsympathetic to working-class men who had to work multiple jobs to support their families? And who reads a book by Jack Welch and defensively feels that they're being told that they have to adopt Jack Welch's lifestyle and professional choices, or they are lesser human beings? Lean In cannot and should not be read as a definitive text, or a book offering universally applicable advice to all women everywhere. Sandberg is confident and aggressive in her advice, but the reader is under no obligation to do everything she says. Perhaps we can consider Lean In for what it is. Just one more reminder that the rules are always different for girls, no matter who they are and no matter what they do. Bad Feminist, Take 2. I am failing as a woman. I am failing as a feminist. To freely accept the feminist label would not be fair to good feminists. If I am indeed a feminist, I am a rather bad one. I am a mess of contradictions. There are many ways in which I am doing feminism wrong, at least according to the way my perceptions of feminism have been warped by being a woman. I want to be independent, but I want to be taken care of and have someone to come home to. I have a job I'm pretty good at. I'm in charge of things. I am on committees. People respect me and take my counsel. I want to be strong and professional, but I resent how hard I have to work to be taken seriously, to receive a fraction of the consideration I might otherwise receive. Sometimes I feel an overwhelming need to cry at work, so I close my office door and lose it. I want to be in charge and respected and in control, but I want to surrender completely in certain aspects of my life. Who wants to grow up? When I drive to work, I listen to thuggish rap at a very loud volume, even though the lyrics are degrading to women and offend me to my core. The classic Yin Yang Twins song, Salt Shaker, it's amazing. Bitch, you gotta shake it till your camel starts to hurt. Poetry. I am mortified by my music choices. I care what people think. Pink is my favorite color. I used to say my favorite color was black to be cool, but it is pink. All shades of pink. If I have an accessory, it is probably pink. I read Vogue, and I'm not doing it ironically, though it might seem that way. I once live tweeted the September issue. I demonstrate little outward evidence of this, but I have a very indulgent fantasy where I have a closet full of pretty shoes and purses and matching outfits. I love dresses. For years I pretended I hated them, but I don't. Maxi dresses are one of the finest clothing items to become popular in recent memory. I have opinions on maxi dresses. I shave my legs. Again, this mortifies me. If I take issue with the unrealistic standards of beauty women are held to, I shouldn't have a secret fondness for fashion and smooth calves, right? I know nothing about cars. When I take my car to the mechanic, they are speaking a foreign language. A mechanic asks, "What's wrong with my car?" And I stutter things like, "Well, there's a sound I try to drown out with my radio." The windshield wiper fluid for the rear window of my car no longer sprays the window. It just sprays the air. I don't know how to deal with this. It feels like an expensive problem. I still call my father with questions about cars and am not terribly interested in changing any of my car-related ignorance. I don't want to be good at cars. Good feminists, I assume, are independent enough to address vehicular crises on their own. They are independent enough to care. Despite what people think based on my opinion writing, I very much like men. They're interesting to me. And I mostly wish they would be better about how they treat women so I wouldn't have to call them out so often. And still, I put up with nonsense from unsuitable men even though I know better and can do better. I love diamonds and the excess of weddings. I consider certain domestic tasks as gendered. Mostly all in my favor, as I don't care for chores, lawn care, bug killing, and trash removal, for example, are men's work. Sometimes, a lot of the time, honestly, I totally fake it, because it's easier. I am a fan of orgasms, but they take time, and in many instances, I don't want to spend that time. All too often, I don't really like the guy enough to explain the calculus of my desire. Then I feel guilty because the sisterhood would not approve. I'm not even sure what the sisterhood is, but the idea of a sisterhood menaces me, quietly, reminding me of how bad a feminist I am. Good feminists don't fear the sisterhood because they know they are comporting themselves in sisterhood-approved ways. I love babies, and I want to have one. I am willing to make certain compromises, not sacrifices, in order to do so, namely maternity leave and slowing down at work to spend more time with my child, writing less so I can be more present in my life. I worry about dying alone, unmarried and childless, because I spent so much time pursuing my career and accumulating degrees. This kind of thinking keeps me up at night, but I pretend it doesn't because I am supposed to be evolved. My success, such as it is supposed to be enough if I'm a good feminist. It is not enough. It is not even close. Because I have so many deeply held opinions about gender equality, I feel a lot of pressure to live up to certain ideals. I am supposed to be a good feminist who is having it all, doing it all. Really, though, I'm a woman in her 30s, struggling to accept herself and her credit score. For so long, I told myself I was not this woman, utterly human and flawed. I worked overtime to be anything but this woman, and it was exhausting and unsustainable and even harder than simply embracing who I am. Maybe I'm a bad feminist, but I am deeply committed to the issues important to the feminist movement. I have strong opinions about misogyny, institutional sexism that consistently places women at a disadvantage, the inequity in pay, the cult of beauty and thinness, the repeated attacks on reproductive freedom, violence against women, and on and on. I am as committed to fighting fiercely for equality as I am committed to disrupting the notion that there is an essential feminism. I'm the kind of feminist who is appalled by the phrase legitimate rape and by political candidates such as Missouri's Todd Akin, who in an interview reaffirmed his commitment to opposing abortion almost unilaterally. He said, "If it's a legitimate rape, the female body has ways to try to shut that whole thing down. But let's assume that maybe that didn't work or something. I think there should be some punishment, but the punishment ought to be of the rapist and not attacking the child." Drawing from pseudoscience and a lax cultural attitude toward rape. Being a feminist, however, even a bad one, has also taught me that the need for feminism and advocacy also applies to seemingly less serious issues like a top 40 song, or a comedian's puerile humor. The existence of these lesser artifacts of our popular culture is made possible by the far graver issues we are facing. The ground has long been softened. At some point, I got it into my head that a feminist was a certain kind of woman. I bought into grossly inaccurate myths about who feminists are. Militant, perfect in their politics and person, man-hating, humorless. I bought into these myths even though intellectually I know better. I'm not proud of this. I don't want to buy into these myths anymore. I don't want to cavalierly disavow feminism like far too many other women have done. Bad feminism seems like the only way I can both embrace myself as a feminist and be myself. And so I write. I chatter away on Twitter about everything that makes me angry and all the small things that bring me joy. I write blog posts about the meals I cook as I try to take better care of myself. And with each new entry, I realize that I am undestroying myself after years of allowing myself to stay damaged. The more I write, the more I put myself out into the world as a bad feminist, but, I hope, a good woman. I am being open about who I am and who I was and where I have faltered and who I would like to become. No matter what issues I have with feminism, I am a feminist. I cannot and will not deny the importance and absolute necessity of feminism. Like most people, I'm full of contradictions, but I also don't want to be treated like shit for being a woman. I am a bad feminist. I would rather be a bad feminist than no feminist at all. This is Bonnie Turpin. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Bad Feminist Essays by Roxane Gay. This program was produced by Dion Audio Services. The director was Mike Hoagie. Executive producer Aaron Wicks. Text copyright 2014 by Roxane Gay. Production copyright 2014 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.